From Virginia to Washington, Texas to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Joe Biden's budget proposals contain additional shots in his war on fossil fuels. Darren Bask from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with analysis. Bernie Moreno has emerged as the Republican nominee for the United States Senate in the key battleground state of Ohio. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. In a number of states, asset forfeiture has gotten out of control, with government seizing property far exceeding the value of the crime. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jim Manley at the Pacific Legal Foundation. And there is a sensible solution to the immigration crisis, but it would take effective presidential and congressional leadership. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Biden administration's proposed 2024-25 fiscal year budget contains yet another attack on affordable energy. Darren Bask is director of the Center for Energy and Environment and is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He joins us now with details. Darren, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Darren, President Joe Biden has put forth his budget proposals for the 24-25 fiscal year. These budgets are usually dead on arrival, but they do give us an indication of the policy prescriptions that the president puts forward. You've been looking specifically at his proposals relative to energy. Let's start out with your overall thoughts on what the president is proposing.
I think that it's important for people to recognize the budget request, that it's more than just the money. It does, as you said, reflect on the policy priorities of an administration. I mean, on the money side, the budget request is $7.3 trillion, which is a lot of money, and it includes a lot of increased spending and taxes. So I think that tells you a little bit about some of their priorities, is more money, more spending, and then imposing taxes. And then on the energy and environmental side, we're just seeing more doubling down on the types of energy and environmental policies the Biden administration has been pushing from the start of its administration, including a lot of subsidies for renewable energy, trying to change the way electricity is produced in this country from reliable sources to less reliable sources, and creating an environment where there's just more regulation on businesses and just individuals and a lot of restrictions on freedom. So that's really a lot of the focus is on climate issues and advancing the Inflation Reduction Act, which the Biden administration supported and which passed about a year and a half ago.
Taking a look at his proposals here, Darren, when you talk about the fossil fuel industry, taken together, his proposals, his policies, what impact are they having on exploration and development? You referenced a lot of the priority is on so-called renewables. We'll talk a bit more about that. But we right now are dependent on fossil fuels. Are we still able to develop our resources in that area?
We are, to be honest. We are developing the fossil fuel resources. But the way that exploration and production work with fossil fuels is it's not like you make a decision today and then the impact is expect a change tomorrow in terms of the actual production. There's a little bit of a time lag. So while we're seeing a decent amount of production right now of fossil fuels, the actions taken now down the line will have an impact. And what the Biden administration has been doing is withdrawing oil lease sales, making it very difficult to drill offshore. In fact, the Biden administration has been boasting about the fact that they're making it so difficult to access oil and gas resources. They're continuously making it more difficult by imposing kind of taxes and more, creating more obstacles for the production and use of fossil fuels, not just in terms of the production side, but also on the demand side, from being able to use what kind of appliances you want to use to kind of drive the kind of cars you want to drive. So all these things will have an impact. So we may not see it today, exactly, but we know that decisions are being made by regulated parties that will be impacted. So in a matter of a couple of years, if we keep going down this path, will certainly see severe restrictions on the fossil fuel availability for Americans, and that will further exacerbate prices. They're already high, as we all know.
Do you see a disconnect here, Darren, between the policies the Biden administration is proposing? For example, the fact that the EPA is trying to force a faster conversion to electric vehicles, yet we have seen major auto manufacturers cut back on the number of EVs that they're producing because there's simply no consumer demand for it. Is the economy and the free market going one direction and the Biden administration going another direction on this?
Yes, they're disconnected from the reality of what consumers want and also technological feasibility. They're also disconnected from any type of belief in actually allowing people to have individual freedom, at least as it relates to the vehicle tailpipe rule that we're referring to. I think it shows a real arrogance by the administration to try to dictate really what kind of cars people should drive, and that's exactly what the administration is trying to do.
As we look at the energy grid, we, of course, are now in the time of year where we don't have as much of a strain on it because we don't have extreme heat or cold at the moment. We're going to get there in just a couple of months. In terms of all these renewables, we have seen some shortages, close to blackouts in some parts of the country, Texas, California, other areas. The Biden administration's policies, are they going to just fan the flames, if you will, of not having enough of supply put into our energy grid, let alone the strain of taking more out of it for EVs?
Yes, you've identified a key problem. It's that double whammy of making it more difficult to produce electricity while at the same time putting more pressure on the electricity grid. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't know if it's going to take some major blackout somewhere, but there's a very good chance something like that will happen. And the administration, I'm not sure that they simply don't care or what, or if they just don't recognize the fact that the pressure that they're putting on the grid in terms of simply not being able to have reliable electricity sources is going to hurt. And then, you have to demand more electricity because of electric vehicles and electric appliances and everything else. They want to make everything electric. They're trying to electrify everything. And it's hard to do that just generally, but it's especially hard to do that when you're doing everything you can to make it possible for the electricity grid to meet the needs of Americans.
Darren Bask is director of the Center for Energy and Environment and a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, tell us a little bit about CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and where can folks go online to learn more?
And to answer your second question, you can visit us at CEI.org. CEI.org. And Competitive Enterprise Institute is a think tank. It's an organization that tries to advance policies that protect our individual freedom and reduce the scope of the administrative state. And we want to ensure that Congress is making the decisions that affect our lives, not the unelected bureaucrats.
Darren Bask of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Of course, we're going state by state through the primary calendar this year. The Buckeye State of Ohio voted this past week. We're going to talk about that and some policy issues with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Lohman.
Big race for the United States Senate seat in Ohio. The Republican nomination has been decided. Your thoughts on that?
Well, listen, this is the race that could ultimately decide the United States Senate. We know that Joe Manchin's retiring in West Virginia, so that basically puts us at a 50-50 Senate with Kamala casting the tie-breaking votes. And in Ohio this week, Ohioans nominated Bernie Moreno to be the Republican candidate to face Sherrod Brown in 2024. Bernie Moreno defeated Matt Dolan and Frank LaRose in what ended up being pretty much a blowout election. Moreno had a big rally the previous weekend with President Trump, and the Trump endorsement continues to do really big things in Ohio. You may recall that Trump endorsed J.D. Vance in 2022, springing him to victory, and we think that this is a big, big state for the president, a big, big flip opportunity for Bernie Moreno to defeat Sherrod Brown.
It seems, though, that the New York Times, as usual, has a little bit different take on all this.
Yeah, well, this week the New York Times wrote a long story about how senior officials within the Republican Party are only recruiting white rich men for the United States Senate races. And Bernie Moreno is one of these first-generation Colombian-American immigrants who really celebrates the American dream. And Bernie is quite wealthy, but he's worked hard for that. This is a system in America that is merit-based, and a lot of people take advantage of our free market capitalist system in order to do well financially. And I think that candidates like Bernie Moreno should be celebrated, not demagogued by legacy media outlets like the New York Times.
And of course, we have seen a lot of demagoguing going on. The big controversy over the last week or so here, Scott, has been about the bloodbath comment that President Trump made. And of course, he was referring to cheap Chinese auto imports. We are also seeing the Biden administration taking a shot at the automobile industry this past week. Seems they don't want us to drive gas-powered cars anymore, and they're trying to force EVs upon us. What did the president do this week?
Well, the president and the Environmental Protection Agency went ahead and finalized new environmental regulations that are intended to reduce tailpipe emissions as part of their bigger conquest to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and combat so-called global warming in America. The bottom line is we often try to manipulate our economy through various things like electric vehicles, and we've seen that with the Inflation Reduction Act and how much the Biden administration tried to push them there. And this is an aggressive standard that ultimately seeks to almost completely reduce the number of new gas-powered vehicles by 2030. And of course, in 6 years, Joe Biden, his presidency would be 6 years past, right? Because he's going to lose his election this time. I think that there's a ton of American voters that are just completely frustrated with this manipulation of the economy and of production and manufacturing by the administration. The Biden administration is also just completely obsessed with electric vehicles, and that puts more of a dependence on lithium batteries. Where do the lithium batteries even come from? They come from China, Chile, and Australia. And so when you think about foreign dependence on these natural resources that are necessary to create the batteries, what the heck are we doing here? What are we doing about slave labor in China? What are we doing to actually innovate in America with maybe finding a way for gas-powered vehicles to be more efficient? And so instead of attacking, I think, an industry that has been a lifeline for the American economy, you see Joe Biden here completely going after them with this new rule that they are trying to push forward. I remember when Obamacare passed and they said, well, this is going to reduce the cost of health care. And then I remember health insurance premiums skyrocketing over, you know, I guess that was in 2009, right? So that was 15 years ago because Obamacare passed, I think, on March 23rd, 2009. And when you think about the cost of vehicles and just how the middle class has been completely punished by the Biden administration and their policies, I don't think that electric vehicles are going to be cheaper than gas-powered vehicles. I don't think that dream of owning a home is going to be any cheaper because of what they've done with interest rates. The bottom line is Joe Biden and his administration are creating an economic situation that puts the American dream out of touch for more Americans than ever before. But it's all on purpose because socialism is about having control over the people. And the control approach here with having electric vehicles and punishing the fossil fuel industry from Texas and all across Oklahoma and other areas that produce large amounts of oil, our coastlines and the Gulf. You think about Louisiana. What are they doing to these red states? They're coming at us with their radical ideas from California. And it's obviously, it's not going to do anything. Think about global emissions. They're not holding the same standard to China or India or any of Europe or other nations that have higher emissions than the United States.
And also, Scott, the fact that federal policy is really outrunning the technology and the innovation, is it not? I mean, this past winter, we saw electric-powered vehicles wouldn't charge in super cold. We saw strains on the energy grid. We're not really prepared for this, are we?
Well, it seems to me that we're not. And when you think about the possibility of an EMP wiping out our electric grid in America, what would that do in terms of an attack from somebody like China? So my concern here is that Joe Biden and the climate radicals that basically run his administration are trying to do everything they can to have that leftward lunge completed over these final months in the Biden administration, because they are about to suffer a wipeout election here in 2024. And what we can do in the United States Senate is use the Congressional Review Act to rescind these burdensome regulations. And we can make sure that we advance new tax incentives to make sure that we've got manufacturing in America that strengthens the economy. And those need to be the priorities, I think, of the next Trump administration. We need to make sure that everybody understands exactly what Joe Biden and those climate activists are doing over in the Biden administration. And that's going to cost a lot of money.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. You can sign up and become a member at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Reining in excessive use of asset forfeiture laws is a goal of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with the foundation's James Manley to learn more.
In some states, if you owe a small property tax debt, you can end up losing your entire home. Yes, and all the equity that you've built up in it. It's a process called home equity forfeiture or home equity theft, sort of the gross stepsister of civil asset forfeiture and eminent domain. And well, our guest today is one of the people who's out there in the states pushing back against this policy. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Jim Manley. He is the state legal policy deputy director at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he joins us now to talk about home equity theft. Jim, thanks for taking some time with us.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've got some great news out of Idaho that I want to get to. But first, I imagine this is a topic that most people probably haven't ever encountered, thankfully, and that many people probably haven't heard about. So tell us a bit about what home equity theft, home equity forfeiture actually is.
Most people, when I tell them what it is, don't believe me that it's a real thing. What it is when the government collects a property tax debt and takes not just what's owed, but the entire property. So we represented a man in Michigan who accidentally underpaid his taxes by $8.41. The notices went to the wrong address, and the county took and sold his home and kept every penny of it over an $8 debt.
I remember writing about that story for Reason when you guys first filed that lawsuit, or right before you did. And I had the exact same reaction that you're talking about there, where I didn't believe the first time I heard about this. Like, wait, this is really a thing that could happen. You could lose hundreds of thousands of dollars possibly in equity over a very small tax debt. But it is a thing that happens. There are laws on the books in a number of states that allow it to happen. But there's one fewer state where this can happen now, thanks to what went on in Idaho last week.
Yeah, and fortunately, Idaho was a state where this didn't happen routinely. There was a loophole in Idaho, and there's a loophole in 9 other states now, that allows the government to simply keep the property. If it decides that it wants to use it for a public purpose and there's a tax debt on it that hasn't been paid after a couple of years, the government can just decide to keep it. And so it's eminent domain without a condemnation, just sort of a backdoor taking, no compensation paid to the owner, and the government gets to walk away with the property free and clear. And fortunately, that can no longer happen in Idaho.
What tell us a little bit more about exactly what the reforms in Idaho do, and I guess is this like a model for what other states could look to do to prevent this, you know, this sort of thing from happening to more people?
Yeah, so right now there are 9 states that do this routinely and 9 states that have a loophole, what we call a loophole, like Idaho. In the 9 states that do it routinely, what they generally do is they will foreclose on the tax debt, and that either means the government owns the tax debt and it forecloses on its lien, or in some states, the government will actually sell the tax debt right up front to an investor, and then the investor gets to collect the taxes and interest, and in most cases, homeowners pay off the property taxes. The investor gets a great interest rate, as high as 16-20% in some states, and the tax debt's paid. But in those states where the investors own the tax debt and the tax debt is not paid, they can walk into court and say, give me title to the property. And that's the case in states like Arizona, Colorado, seven other states right now. And so then you've got your loophole states like Idaho, where that doesn't happen routinely. Ordinarily, when the government has a property tax, delinquent property, they'll simply sell it, pay off the tax debt, and give the rest back to the owner of the property. It's just in those rare situations where the government decides to keep it that it ends up taking all of the equity. And there are still nine states on the books right now. There's a bill actually heading to the governor's desk in Wisconsin, very similar to the Idaho bill, that will solve the problem there too.
Great to see that we're having some progress on this in other places as well. I mean, as you point out, there's really sort of like a predatory cronyism element to this too. It's one of these things that honestly, the more you look at it, I mean, it seems insane when you first look at it, and then it actually just gets worse and worse the more you learn. Folks can learn more about this by checking out PLF's work at pacificlegal.org. They do a lot of fantastic work on this topic and on a bunch of other things. We're talking with Jim Manley. He's the State Legal Policy Deputy Director for PLF. Jim, not a lot of time left here, but I do want to mention there was a case that you guys took all the way to the Supreme Court. I think this was a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. And Chief Justice John Roberts had a great line in the majority opinion where he said that the taxpayer must render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but no more. If the Supreme Court sort of put an end to this with that ruling, why is it still going on in a bunch of states?
That unanimous ruling is actually the reason that the states are so active right now. This is not a situation, oftentimes when the Supreme Court decides a case that something's unconstitutional, just stop it is what the states need to do to respond. The tax foreclosure process is so complicated in every state and unique in every state that we needed to go in and actually change the laws to address this decision. And so that's what you're seeing now. You're seeing states react to our win in the Tyler case and to wipe these laws off the books and reconfigure their tax foreclosure process so that it doesn't take equity any longer.
Well, it's great to see that. It's great to see states heeding this directive from the Supreme Court and making these changes. And of course, great to see you folks at PLF leading the charge on all of this, taking it to court, winning in court, and then following through with the policy changes at the state level. Jim, thanks so much for taking some time and walking us through all that today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for bringing attention to the issue.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Really appreciate that. Again, you can check out PLF's work online at pacificlegal.org. Really fantastic stuff that they do on a variety of topics. Check out our coverage of this issue and other issues that are happening in D.C. and in state capitals around the country at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
More legal immigration and less illegal immigration is the solution to the nation's current immigration crisis. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Our immigration system is anything but systematic. Legal immigration takes too long. Illegal immigration is, by definition, uncontrolled and dangerous. So here's a simple but sweeping policy principle that I propose for your consideration. We should make legal immigration easier and illegal immigration harder. There are five broad categories of immigrants. The first is those seeking employment or asylum and a better way of life. Some of them may be helpful to our nation if they match specific labor shortages. But the other four categories of immigrants should be barred to the extent possible. Drug traffickers, human traffickers, those who pose a public health risk, and those who pose a national security risk, including prior deportees and individuals on the federal terrorism watch list. Since the number of people worldwide who want to come to the U.S. far exceeds the number that the U.S. can accept, legal immigration limits should be tailored to benefit our economy. There is a genuine labor shortage in America, ranging from relatively low-skilled laborers, which I'll call basic labor, to highly technical specialties requiring advanced education and experience. Roughly 16% of all jobs in the U.S. can be characterized as basic labor, work that requires minimal specialized skills and experience, and for which the required training is measured in hours or days rather than months or years. Another 15% of American jobs require considerable training, such as many in the healthcare, hospitality, and transportation industries, but little or no academic coursework or degrees. Each of those job categories has a labor shortage in the millions. Taken together with agricultural jobs, the total labor shortage not requiring advanced training, experience, or degrees is slightly below 10 million. Unfilled jobs create a drag on our economy. Filling them boosts our economy. It is therefore in our economic interest to admit workers to fill those jobs. They must be identified with some form of traceable electronic identification, such as photo IDs, with one or more pieces of biometric data that cannot be easily forged. Those IDs must be verified for employment of all non-citizens. Processing can be simplified, expedited, and administered at border entry points. Transportation to employment centers can be provided. A few million more highly skilled workers in fields such as technology and building trades can also help our economy, and we should welcome them as well. Foreign workers admitted under this program could become eligible for citizenship after at least 10 years of arrest-free employment and paying taxes, easily verifiable through pay records. Extended unemployment can be identified and the worker placed on probation or even deported if he or she remains unproductive. At the southern border in particular, a secure physical infrastructure must be installed along nearly its entire length. Call it a wall or a fence, it must be a barrier to illegal entry with enough gates to allow the regular monitored flow of commerce as well as legal immigration. If a high volume of illegal entry shifts to the northern border, a physical barrier may need to be installed there as well, although a well-administered immigrant ID requirement as a precondition to employment and an increase in the appropriate occupational quotas should dramatically reduce the appeal of illegal immigration. The border must be staffed with enough agents, assisted by technology, to apprehend the vast majority of illegal entrants, and those apprehended must be subject to immediate deportation. In politically assessing this program, Democrats will support easing the process by which immigrants can be admitted legally and matched to employment opportunities, along with a 10-year path to citizenship for those who pay their taxes and stay out of trouble. Republicans will support a robust employment ID requirement that also provides the ability to locate any ID holder. Both will take credit for the economic benefits, and each will claim that they solved a previously intractable national problem without racism or xenophobia. All that's required to bring this plan into reality is leadership. And that's what neither the current administration nor the current Congress has, so we're likely to remain mired in dysfunction. Could the listeners to American Radio Journal be the catalyst that breaks this stalemate? Write to us at AmericanRadioJournal.com and click on the Contact tab. Let us know your thoughts, and we may feature them on a future broadcast. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBRI-AM in Indianapolis, Indiana, WYYC-AM in York, Pennsylvania, along with WIJD-AM in Mobile, Alabama. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.